I'm having money for Sean.
Well, hi and welcome. Thanks for joining even during Thanksgiving week. I hope you have a terrific week planned. I know there may be questions or comments or things to clarify since the last seminar I went fully to the end of the time to be sure and get everything in, and we didn't have time for discussion. So I'm eager to hear any thoughts or questions or reflections about what you heard about the material or the applications, and especially if you're finding it useful for what you have in mind and are finding the exercises at the end of the outline useful. Your thoughts, your questions, I'm very eager to hear from you. anyone, any questions, any things that you would like to talk further about? Then if not, we'll move into the material, but I want to be sure that that this is really meeting your needs and is applied in a way that you find beneficial and usable in your particular work, in your professional practice. So anything at all that would be helpful for me to know? Are you finding the exercises useful? Well, I'm going to keep talking. I'm going to keep recording, and I will save some time at the end. So if there are questions at that point, please let me know. Okay, we're on presentation mode now. We're going to talk in this seminar about peak performance under pressure and some of the things that I think you'll find beneficial, perhaps for yourself and certainly for your clients, in looking at some aspects of that I have found really useful and found helpful to approach in a more systematic way. First is to look at an optimum performance mindset, to enter first the ideal mindset for any task, to access the knowledge, the practice that you've done in that mindset, the skill set, and the whole way of experiencing in that developed software program. So first consider this, and you know this, although this may be in slightly different words. Your physiological response in your body to excitement and to fear are exactly the same. Your body doesn't know the difference. Your brain registers it in the same way. The only difference between excitement and fear is what your brain tells you when you interpret it. So with a response of fear or anxiety, your mind and brain search for what's wrong and lights on something that consciously makes sense and connects cause and effect. This association then creates closure, linking a physiological response with a negative meaning reads as fear. So just before you begin a task in which you have increased activation of alertness, heart racing, sweaty palms, instead of automatically linking anxiety or fear, then looking for what caused it or what can go wrong, consider substitute the framing of, I'm excited, I'm ready. This is a reframe to ask, why am I ready to do this? This provides a positive mindset of engagement and a framework of anticipatory readiness. This provides the brain a context of excitement rather than of anxiety or fear. Performance anxiety is an indication of how much you care, both about performance and outcome. It's normal, even necessary, to feel anxious as preparation for optimum performance, because in reading it as a way of, this is an activation, this is an excitement, this is necessary in order to perform in the best way. Consider the anxiety as your mind and body preparing itself to perform, and then execute the successful way that you practiced. Attention awakens the prefrontal cortex for you to then insert the current framework and state of mind that you determine in the present moment, rather than an instant state shift into anxiety and negative thinking. So a key to constant and consistent performance is to electively enter, to make a choice to enter and sustain an optimum state of mind for a performance task. Preparation includes self-reflection to identify and monitor the specific state of mind for the specific performance. Consistency then requires having a systematic strategy to remain grounded and centered so that No subsequent experience or event disrupts that state of flow and a way to reboot if derailed. We're going to talk about and review the roadmap system toward the end of this seminar. A significant number of studies find that the most common psychological characteristics of an optimum performance state are these five. Confidence with positive expectations about the performance. Full concentration with focus on the present task. Strong determination and commitment. Feeling energized yet relaxed. And a mental toughness of determined focus under pressure. These are in your outline. I'm just reviewing them here to kind of set up what I want to discuss as we begin to think about and apply these and look at the things that both facilitate and the things that interfere or get in the way of expediting them. Mastery of all aspects of pressure situations means being aware of emotional triggers of thoughts, feelings, or events that could disrupt focus and state, including extreme success and extreme failure, which we'll talk about in next seminar. A routine is effective because when it's repeated enough, the brain creates a neural pathway and network to make this the default mode, a habit, to become automatic without requiring effort. Studies show that athletes who use a pre-performance routine do perform better than those who don't. This systematic entry into an optimum performance state, a pre-performance routine, ensures access to the software specific to the deliberate practice and execution of a skill. A routine can both guide focus and enhance a sense of effectiveness and mastery to execute a best plan of action throughout a performance. An example may be a brief mantra before a keynote to get in an optimum state. I want to consider another aspect that I think you'll find interesting and has been found extremely effective in both pressure situations and situations of the need for exquisitely high performance. The quiet eye is a concept from sports science. It's a strategy of attentional control. The quiet eye is a selective focus on the most significant target immediately prior to the execution of a practice skill. I'll give you a couple of examples in a moment. The quiet eye is the final step of any important performance sequence. And this has been shown to be especially important when performing under pressure. Eye-tracking research on the quiet eye shows that for a precise motor task, like free-throw shooting, putting, tying a surgical knot, experts maintain quiet eye 62% longer than non-experts. Quiet eye focuses specifically to increase precision. Dr. Joan Vickers, professor of kinesiology at the University of Calgary, showed a free throw accuracy increase by 22% after quiet eye training. Here's what she did. She emphasized to specifically focus on a single spot on the hoop itself, such as midway between the front and center, and to continue to do so through that shot. Begin at least a full second before initiating the shot and not shift eye focus even for a nanosecond. A quick fluid motion of the shot without losing focus on the quiet eye spot becomes most successful. Academic and business and professional performers can learn a great deal from research in athletic settings to apply this quiet eye concept. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain and has the functional role of readying the entire system for the next step. Quiet eye training enhances the default motor system execution of skills for a specific target. It's just a specific way to have exquisite and pure focus on the next thing and to sustain that focus throughout whatever action or sequence it is. Sports science shows the benefits of choosing the best visual target for purposeful and goal-directed eye movements. For example, when basketball players miss free shots, they often spontaneously move focus from the rim to where the ball is going and the ball itself, even for a nanosecond. Another example, when soccer players miss a penalty shot, it's been found that they may instantaneously compromise their focus from the destination of a specific spot just inside the goal post to the goalkeeper and shift that quiet eye focus from that target spot to the goalkeeper, which moves the specificity of the ultimate target of scoring the goal. So it's a compromise. Or an executive is sidetracked by an emotional reaction to a colleague or by a colleague. Let's combine this now with something I think that we're all familiar with as mentor coaches, although we may not conceptualize it exactly in this way. Here's a case scenario, and I'll present the idea in the form of a story first. A CEO, I'm going to call Dan, had a tragedy at his company of a serious accident and on-the-job injuries and a death at one of the operating sites. In the 3 months since the accident, he had stress-related symptoms of losing sleep, depleted energy, and preoccupation with safety, all very understandable. He recognized that his responses hampered his effectiveness as an executive and his ability to provide the leadership that his company needed. I asked Dan, as we began, what went through his mind the moment he woke up? His answer immediately was, what could go wrong today? He described questions about what he could do for his company, how he could not feel helpless, how he could assure the group about there being no more accidents, how he would mitigate any potential future danger. He recognized that the mindset that he began each day for the 3 months since the event had been essentially the same, and that mindset set the tone for both himself and his corporation. His concern had permeated not only his executive team, but to each employee. Remember how we talked about states of mind being contagious? He knew he had to do something different, but he wasn't quite sure what to do, and nothing seemed to work for very long, for the entire 3 months. We began with a very simple approach. I suggested he try something different. I explained that we're always asking ourselves questions, whether or not we're conscious of them, from the instant we wake up. And this internal conversation sets in motion a mindset immediately to initiate the day. This inner dialogue is usually pretty unconscious, but at stressful times, it can include questions like his. What's going to happen today? Will I be able to handle it? What do I need to be afraid of today? I suggested that sometime during the day or evening, before he went to bed, that he write down 3 questions that would put him in an empowered, positive state of mind, questions that would focus on his effectiveness, that he could instantly answer those questions and boot up a state of mind of confidence and mastery, and to answer those questions each morning as soon as he woke up. The next week at our session, he immediately reported the difference those questions had made. He recognized he had previously begun each day with negative self-talk, creating a mindset of lack of confidence and subsequent stress. And with that mindset, he had processed in the remainder of the day and how contagious it was for his organization. He knew that was not what had created his successes. By shifting consciously to positive self-talk, he booted up a positive mindset that built on itself throughout the day. This initial reframing of his self-narrative to direct the power of focus to launch a positive state of mind to engage the day became a model that he passed on directly and indirectly to his organization. He noticed, he said, within days, the impact it had on his executive team and how this change trickled down throughout his organization. Self-talk becomes an internal dialogue that builds confidence and creates affirmations that directly enhance performance. Think about how it can affect you when it's negative. What if I can't do this? God, I feel like an imposter. I don't think I have the necessary resources to carry this out. Now, remember that like any focus, what we know from neuroscience and quantum physics, we get what we focus on, not what we want. Self-talk focus should not counter the negative, because that engages the negative, but focus on the positive and the empowering. Remember, always, we get what we focus on. The unconscious does not know the difference between positive or negative, just the focus. A positive self-talk in the present moment immediately can replace negative focus. It's important to recognize that a different set of strategies, including self-talk and affirmations, will be needed in different performance arenas, not the same for everything. In athletics, a runner may need a focus phrase of powerful and steady, or keep your pace, or no matter what, during races, or an I am the storm to keep up from knocking off early for a single malt and a cigar. The focus phrase needs to fit the endeavor. A different example to more effectively get to sleep at night may be the phrase, relax to sleep. Just make the phrase fit the state of mind and the task that you want. It's been shown repeatedly that self-talk can enhance performance. To be most effective, self-talk needs to be brief, specific, and focused. Ideally, a very short phrase that represents a whole sequence and series of experiences that can be immediately booted up. An initial focus phrase can instantly evoke a state of mind that can be ideally matched for the task at hand. The stories we tell ourselves, our self-talk of internal conversation, often frames our experiences to either sustain it or to short-circuit it. So this is just a brief discussion about framing self-talk for resilience. Self-awareness becomes a crucial component in both monitoring and understanding this process. And think about this. The most common reason you don't get what you want is the story you tell yourself about why you can't have it. Self-talk can enhance resilience and facilitate rebound from failure. Engineering professors David Franklin and Daniel Wolpert have identified 5 mechanisms of brain operation when someone successfully bounces back from failure and setback. Each brain mechanism has a specific corresponding brain function to allow us to directly access an inner dialogue for self-talk to rebound from failure with resilience and transform to success. First, redirect negative feedback. Whether it's external or internal, it focuses energy in the brain in a negative way. Reflection questions for redirecting negative feedback can include these. What can I learn from this? What are the possibilities here? In other words, rather than the problems. 2, obstacles are created. Consider that the obstacle you're experiencing is not something external, not something you simply need to strategize a way to avoid or overcome, but that the obstacle is not there until you create it by the way you see or frame something. To say this a different way, an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. Show me an obstacle, I'll show you a desire. When, and this is the important mentor coaching principle, when you're ready to consider that you're creating the obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So a self-reflection question here, what would it be like to not create the obstacle and instead put the energy into what you want? 3, use systematic forecasting. We each have invisible brain algorithms to predict the future. Our brain creates new pathways and networks for anything that we repeat, so it develops a default mode to save energy. These hardwired patterns or habits become predictive because they create the story that we anticipate even unconsciously. They're not all habits. They're not all involving behaviors, but these are attachment patterns, emotional patterns, and the kinds of patterns that we have just when we interact with people. To preempt this automatic system, we have to consciously self-reflect to see if the software developed at an earlier time and place is applicable for the current situation, or if it's outdated and we need to predict and respond differently. So a self-reflection question here is my usual pattern optimum for this current situation? Now also think about these self-reflection questions, questions that you can ask your client, for those of you who are mentor coaches, when you hear these. 4, assess the current model. Self-reflect to assess the effectiveness of what you're doing and if it's working. This requires, at times, disruption of automatic expectations and not continuing to inhabit the story that you want to believe. A self-reflection question here, is this plan really working or not? And when you think about one of the most fundamental things that we do as coaches is if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. And 5, the output channel is essential. No matter how much we acquire information, study, and learn, it's by putting it into action, the output channel, as we discussed last seminar, that we can not only enhance effectiveness, but actually create a performance memory. The output channel completes the cycle in the brain so that it's not just passive learning or information or input, but there's an entire cycle of output. The self-reflection question here may be, what do I next need to put into action? So let's look now at performing under pressure. All teams, from business organizations to sports, like to think they do their best when the stakes are highest, when the future rests on the immediate outcome. But that's actually not how it happens. How you handle yourself in difficult and challenging moments determines success more than how you handle yourself in normal times. In extensive studies of teams, Professor Heidi Gardner at Harvard saw 3 performance pressure patterns that can compromise results. And I think these are huge to be able to characterize it like this from research. When teams, including sports to executive teams, become caught up in the risks of failure rather than the pursuit of excellence, they revert to standard and safe practices instead of seeking original solutions, or to the default mode rather than to stick with the new game plan. Secondly, when teams face significant performance pressure, they tend to defer to high-status members rather than using expert members and information. Now, this is more subtle than it may look. If you've got Tom Brady on your team, you definitely want to defer to a high status member. But in organization, especially consulting experts about new information, this is something to really consider. Or you as a coach may be the person with new information and looking at how do you convey this most optimally. And third, when an individual or team either fails to perform well when strongly favored or squanders a big lead in an important event due to excessive pressure. That's the third pattern. Research on performing under pressure consistently shows that most people perform below their capacity when they're under pressure. This occurs in instances ranging from parallel parking in a driving test to a big job interview or to a major business deal. Pressure erodes behavior skills and our ability to perform unless, and this is where you're earning your money as a mentor coach, unless it's managed in an informed, systematic manner. So here are three simple definitions that we'll be discussing. Stress is generated in any situation with too many demands, too few resources to meet the demands, such as energy, time, or money. Pressure results from the significance we give a situation, the expectations we place on our performance, and our stakes often in the outcome. And this is a review for you. State of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program, that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. State of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavior patterns of deliberate practice. So success most often has to do with how we manage our internal state under pressure-inducing circumstances. Those who develop pressure management strategies create optimum performance. Without strategies in pressure situations, focus can become concentrated and narrow to result in a range from mental rigidity all the way to impulsivity. So let's talk about developing resilience in performance. Theo Epstein guided the Boston Red Sox to their first World Series victory in 86 years. Then he agreed in 2011 to lead the Chicago Cubs, whose last World Series championship was in 1908. The Cubs then won in 2016, 108 years later. Widely touted as having an innate and rare intelligence to deconstruct a situation to its simplest form and generate strategic possibilities, he was asked how he decides what he looks for in putting together a team. A very simple question, but very important. His answer, I think, was exquisitely simple. He indicated that he scouts the person more than the player. Epstein says the first thing he wants to know about any potential player is how he has handled adversity. Resilience grows by converting mistakes into lessons. By reflecting on and learning from mistakes, we convert a regrettable experience into a learning experience. Resilience is the ability to modulate and constructively harness the stress response, essential to both physical and mental health. Success in any arena hinges on resilience. Management of setbacks to productively progress becomes an essential process of optimal performance. Persistence toward a goal in the face of challenges characterizes success for athletes to executives. A resilient individual is not someone who avoids stress, but someone who learns effectively how to master it and to optimize performance while doing so. So, here's, again, a very highly condensed summary. Studies show someone can boost resilience in these four ways, these four strategies, reinterpreting negative events, the reframing that we talked about at the beginning of this seminar, enhancing positive emotions, self-talk, asking questions that put you in a powerful state, becoming physically fit because you build up the resilience and increase the threshold of any experience of pressure or stress, and four, maintaining a supportive social network. And from that, you can imitate resilient role models as well as get support. The ability to regulate states of mind and manage emotions is central to establishing resilience. There are two approaches that have been demonstrated in recent research to regulate states of mind and enhance resilience: cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation. Let me give you a simple summary of both of these. Cognitive reappraisal reframes from a negative to a positive. You can't get any more simple than that, but it's exquisitely important. The thing that we do as a bedrock of coaching, from problem to possibility, in order to reinterpret the meaning of an adverse event, to see it as a challenge, as an opportunity, from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. A Mount Sinai School of Medicine study of Vietnam prisoners of war found that those who had actively reappraised their imprisonment to find meaningful ways in which to grow stronger and more resilient showed far and away the most adaptive responses. And the second, mindfulness meditation. We did the exercise. We've discussed this. Mindfulness meditation focuses simply on how to get grounded and centered in the present moment rather than dwelling on the past, fretting about the future, engaging in negative rumination, to unfocus, to focus specifically, for example, on breathing. It's been associated with improved ability to focus, increased flexibility of thinking, and greater psychological well-being. Both cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation have been shown to increase activation of the left prefrontal cortex, a brain activation pattern associated with greater emotional control, boost of positive emotions, and faster recovery from uncomfortable feelings. A very simple acronym is STOP. This is a quick fix version of mindfulness meditation. STOP is an acronym for stop, take a breath, observe what's going on, proceed. Recent articles in the Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind indicate that regulation of the state of mind and self-reflection is the most important quality in excellent performance. And they looked at this in executives and CEOs in business, but I think it goes across the board for everyone. Mindfulness and meditation become a micro practice in which a leader guides the energy of another or the group to focus on a specific task. Now, at times, we may view rest as passive, such as an athlete seeing it as not training. Dr. Sereni Pillay, a colleague and a buddy of mine who is a neuroscientist at Harvard, has written, I would highly recommend his book, Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try. He calls this unfocus, framing rest and unfocused time as supporting achievement and focus that creates a framework that's effective and proactive. In this reframe, rest becomes a crucial component of work performance. This kind of rest in an active process is both physiologically and psychologically important. We do our best efforts by intense periods of sustained focus and work, followed by short breaks. So the breaks become a part of the process. Breaks are part of a process of deliberate practice as well as performance. In one study measuring specific tasks of creativity, those who took a 6-minute walk outdoors each hour increased their creative output following the walk by 60%. This is in Guilford's alternate use test. This was the same even if they only took one walk per day. Same numbers. Those who took a similar 6-minute walk indoors increased their productivity by 40%. Walking disengages focused concentration, and it allows tapping into unconscious processes, including creativity, but it's a break from intense mental focus. Now, here's something I think is interesting, and I'd like you to consider some of the, again, very recent research that comes from different disciplines, but I think it can be applied here. And this is a discussion of playing to win versus playing not to lose. We seek pleasure by playing to win. We avoid pain by playing not to lose. When you play not to lose, you most likely assure loss because this shifts the operating system of the brain. The brain has two separate neurochemical systems and pathways. One neural system is wired to seek pleasure by winning. And this is not just athletic. This is whatever you want to win at. The other system is wired to curtail risk and avoid mistakes, to avoid pain and play not to lose. Some of the distinctions of playing to win versus playing not to lose. To not angrily react to someone when you're angry or offended. To not impulsively eat that delicious but unhealthy brownie. To stay focused on a need, an ideal, rather than an immediate want. To not instinctively respond to an emotional trigger. To not respond to another player or executive or colleague in an impulsive response. So, with gain orientation, we take risks and look for potential reward. Prevention orientation generates caution to avoid risk. Now, there are some areas or professions, you know, firefighters, police, there are professions where prevention orientation has to prevail and at times needs to be in the foreground. The closer we get to a goal, the greater the weight of the tendency to shift into prevention orientation. An application here. A situation can be seen as a challenge, the perception of opportunity to shift mindset to the reward center to take risks, activating the gain orientation system. A threat warns us to shut down to avoid mistakes. Now, these are two very different mindsets, two different levels of performance and results. Most successful performance is in the challenge mindset. So here's a kind of a simple summary juxtaposition of the distinctions of focusing on winning versus focusing on losing. Playing to win is based in confidence. Playing not to lose is based in fear. Playing to win optimizes performance. Playing not to lose becomes defensive. Playing to win is thriving and superiority. Playing not to lose is surviving and often mediocre. Playing to win creates special experiences and memories. Playing not to lose creates stressful experiences and moments. And finally, playing to win optimizes abilities. Playing not to lose compromises the free flow of the expression of those abilities. Now, one thing I want to consider as a final area of discussion today is performance anxiety management. Now, remember, performance can depend on whether you interpret anxiety or excitement. When viewed as a necessary component to boost performance, it can fuel optimum performance. So focus needs to remain on the state of flow and the successful execution of the skill, whatever its nature. A worry, thought, or fear of failure can boot up a mindset to avoid pain and play not to lose. Consider recognizing any of these as error messages from your brain in order to instantly refocus on optimum mindset and reframe in a performance flow. In elite performance of any type, there are some unique issues around success competition. I want to consider the four most common success completion issues: choking, sandbagging, self-handicapping, and burnout, and how to prevent each. First, choking. When Jackie Robinson grabbed his throat in a game between St. Louis and the Dodgers, when umpire Bill Stewart badly missed a call, Stewart threw him out of the game. Choking became a common term for blowing it, though it's a relatively recent term. That game was in 53. Choking usually refers to not executing a specific skill under pressure that you would most likely execute under normal situations. So here are some common scenarios of choking: botching a routine behavior, such as catching a pass in a big game; flubbing a well-practiced presentation; forgetting lines that an actor has said hundreds of times; blanking on the name of someone that you know quite well. Understanding how choking happens will help reduce its occurrence and promote optimum performance. When any performer instantly shifts from the bottom up, system one, to the top down, system two, to think even for a second about technique, or stepwise execution, or to want to be sure not to make a mistake, this dramatically alters the outcome of flow and performance, athletic to intellectual. So what can you do? Well, the best answer is don't do it. Prevention. But here's the longer version of that answer. Two particular behaviors increase pressure and distort the ability to perform under pressure. One is framing a situation as a unique experience. This is my biggest game. There'll be never be another opportunity like this. Today I make history. Thinking of a pressure moment as a single shot heightens the sense of risk and loss. With athletes, for example, loss aversion creates a behavior of playing not to lose instead of playing to win. In the 2017 American League Baseball Championships, the starting Astros pitcher in Game 3 against the Yankees was Charlie Martin, a fantastic pitcher. When he was interviewed before the game, he said, "This is the biggest game of my life." My response as an Astros fan was, "Uh-oh." The Yankees got 6 runs in the first 2 innings. You know, you see how right my grandmother was? If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. And the second behavior that increases pressure and distorts the ability to perform, exaggerating a situation, becoming too attached to the outcome, intensified thoughts of fear and anxiety, especially focusing on failure versus success. Anxiety causes a shift of state, so the performer loses focus and moves away from working memory. The meaning we ascribe to an event, which then dictates our response, creates both pressure and stress. Changing the way we view anxiety and pressure can change a negative impact on our performance. Mastering the regulation of states of mind is the most important variable to determine success. I know I've said that a number of times, and I meant to. In fact, our greatest challenge is to regulate states of mind through various emotional triggers and charged situations, including extreme success, perhaps the greatest challenge. In high-pressure situations, the ability to remain focused and regulate a state of mind both affects both mindset and behavior. Here's another example of that. In research examining 185 venture capital pitches, the chief variables of calmness, passion, eye contact, and confidence were far greater predictors of outcome than content, experience, and expertise. These behavioral responses to pressure of sustaining a balanced state of mind and specific mindset of confidence generated the most favorable outcomes. Okay, a second area that I want to consider with you is self-handicaps. Sports psychologist Dr. Eddie O'Connor reports the recognition of his process of self-handicapping as a runner. He recognized in not reaching his goal for the half mile in 2:10 that he was holding back to have something left at the end of each race, coupled with the hope that he could get there the next time by trying harder. He recognized that preserving the hope of doing better was what was interfering with doing better. Self-handicaps are performance barriers or inhibitions created to protect someone's sense of self-esteem and confidence. If there is failure, the self-talk can then become that it isn't because of poor quality, but some outside circumstance to preserve hope. I can always try harder. The remedy for self-handicaps, self-reflection, and awareness of this process. A third area, sandbagging. Sandbagging attempts to demonstrate in some way a limitation or negative aspect to diminish others' expectations of you. Sandbagging is designed to diminish the pressure of performance anxiety. In one study, sandbaggers who predicted lesser performance actually made it a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, I may have lost, but it's because I really didn't try. Both self-handicapping and sandbagging are designed to preserve integrity and to avoid pain, yet both produce the results they most attempt to avoid. Honest self-reflection of both experience and performance can illuminate either of these processes to then address a more successful outcome and resolution. Self-reflection is a key component to recognizing, owning, assessing, and deciding what to do to change any aspect of performance. These are the first four steps of the roadmap. You have that system, and we'll just briefly do an overview of that in a moment. So a specific remedy for sandbagging, change self-talk. And four, burnout. Burnout is a syndrome comprised of a collection of aspects, including a diminished emotional drive, concentration, motivation, and enthusiasm for an endeavor, often the result of a chronic experience of stressful performance. Someone experiences tension, fatigue, and lethargy, along with a lessened desire to engage with passion and consistency. The remedy for burnout: mindfulness with reappraisal and re-engagement. So finally, I want just to highlight in your outline the pressure management tools that I've detailed there. A strategy or method to regulate pressure moments can create optimum performance. Regulating a state of mind, perhaps reframing the pressure of the moment, can focus and guide behavior. So this is just a brief overview of pressure management tools. Each of these can be utilized and engaged for yourself and with your clients. These are considerations to both regulate and redirect focus and flow at a moment of pressure, and to plan for them beforehand. Get grounded and centered. Access the state of mind that's optimal for the task, and to stay focused in this state. Perhaps recall previous successes. Reflecting on past successes and similar instances ignites confidence and a positive mindset in order to guide best practice. Reframe the pressure moment as a challenge for opportunity. reflect on the purpose. This mindset keeps the larger purpose in mind to sustain anchoring. Create a positive vision of the outcome. This visualization of successful outcome activates new neural pathways each time you revisit it and new networks in the brain to maintain a positive state of mind. Consider each situation as an opportunity to develop and improve. Reduce the importance of a pressure moment. No matter how singular an opportunity seems, life continues to give us many more chances. Confidence is a state of mind. Remember our discussion on that. Keep ideals and positive attributes in focus. Sustain focus on what you can control. Acknowledge but don't give energy to what you can't determine. And refocus on what you can be effective in doing. Perhaps use a brief mantra to stay grounded. A cue to anchor focus in physiology, the two most powerful ways to regulate state of mind. Train or practice under pressure conditions. Anticipate beforehand unexpected situations or challenges and problems. And finally, use the roadmap system for performing under pressure. Now here's kind of a sidebar trick. Variation of the mantra in a pressure situation or competitive moment is to squeeze a ball with your left hand if you're right-handed. Right-handed athletes squeeze the ball in their left hand before competing to prime the right hemisphere of the brain associated with automatic, fluid, unconscious neural pathways for automatic skills. Activation of the right hemisphere also tones down the left hemisphere thoughts about success or failure or any negative self-talk. So, the roadmap introduction, and I've included this in your outline because what I'd suggest that you do is use this as an exercise. And here's just a prep for you to ideally schedule an appointment with yourself to put this system into effect for you, and I'll make a couple of guiding comments about how to do that. Remember, I asked in our first seminar, do you know how to decipher existing programming and write new code for your brain? Somewhere inside each of us are algorithms, the self-contained sequence patterns for behaviors, attachment, and emotions. We may not know the formula for each of the algorithms, but we see the clues, the manifest behavior patterns. The important aspects of the unconscious operating system will manifest in the process of your engagement with other people and in your life. It will come alive in the mentor coaching process with your clients to be directly accessed, evaluated, and changed by the coach-client collaboration. The roadmap system can help you develop awareness of states of mind and facilitate engagement of an optimum state for stress mastery and peak performance. It's simply a means of story editing to redirect narratives for change in behavior to create a new performance story. And the outline is simply a summary overview. In the training I do for New Money Story Mentors and New Life Story Wellness coaches, there are over 150 pages dedicated to these basic principles to have tools and exercises to facilitate. So this is a summary, but it's an applicable summary for this specific purpose. And I want to do just a brief review to give you an idea of one way to use this method for yourself. The roadmap system is simply a means of deconstructing story elements and story editing to redirect narratives for changes in behavior. In this application, to develop awareness of states of mind and facilitate engagement of an optimum performance state. So, here's the prompt for the exercise. Return to your neural conditioning chart. Work with the first emotional trigger you wrote. Go through these seven steps for that issue in your story to use as an illustration to roadmap a state of mind for performing under pressure. And this outline and just a very succinct summary statement of each step is in your outline. I would suggest you put this in your output channel and apply it to see what you think about it, to see if you might find it useful for work with clients. And I want to just highlight the final step. Program your peak performance identity to transform how and who you see yourself doing and being in the performance zone. Incorporate the new behavior as part of your core self. One of the most powerful forces of human psyche, as I mentioned before, is that we always return to our core identity. It's like when someone trips, you learn their native language. When new behavior is incorporated into core identity, it becomes permanent. Change that lasts as default mode. Your brain is rewired. This is what makes change permanent. We're in discussion mode now, and I'm eager to hear any questions or thoughts or reflections about what we've discussed or any clarifications. How are you hearing this and its usefulness to you?
Hi.
Thank you. Okay, I was getting lonely. Go ahead.
This is Catherine.
Catherine. Okay, welcome.
Hello. I'm sorry. I joined a couple minutes late. I'm sorry about that. But I'm finding it very useful. I did have kind of a stammer and stutter kind of thing in one of my classes a while ago. And
I didn't quite hear you.
I said a stammer and a stutter. I kind of fell apart. I'll be honest. I fell apart.
We all have those moments.
I will never be a coach. I will not be able to do this. I can't undo who I am, who I became through being a project manager. And so what, this course has been immensely helpful to me. But what I really like is the fact that you've given us these tools, because what I wrote down in the chart on page 14, I have to go back to it, the neural conditioning to make changes that last. I wrote down that I have a feeling of ineptness. This was a couple weeks ago. And so I wrote down, I have this feeling of ineptness. And in working through the roadmap, I know that I can reprogram myself to know that I can do it. And once I learn how to do it, then I can apply this with my clients. Because they're kind of in the same situation that we're all in too when we get like that. So does that make any sense?
And there's a scientific. Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead. No.
There's a scientific term for the phenomenon that you just described, and it's called being human. So I think you very wisely are really getting the essence of how important it is for us to really be clear about our story and be writing the most optimum story possible, that we can then help our clients do the same thing with theirs, not ghostwriting theirs, but helping them as a catalyst to develop their own stories from the position of having fully developed ours. That's the best preparation we can make. And when we have a systematic way to facilitate their doing it, that becomes even more powerful. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
An outstanding application.
And Thank you.
A conversion from an experience and negative self-talk to what you can learn from that. That's a growth mindset in action that we just heard. So thank you very much for that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. I know we're out of time, but is there any other question or comment before we have to stop? Well, thank you all very much. I hope you have, for those of you in the U.S., a very happy Thanksgiving. And I look forward to picking up for our final seminar next Monday to look at extreme success and the various aspects of that. Thank you all. And if you have any questions, jot them down or send them to me in an email, and we'll go over them. So until next week, thanks, and have a super week and holiday. Bye now.
Thank you.